to introduce Fionnuala Downey. Some of you may not know that she is also a Dr. Fionnuala Downey, a Doctor of Philosophy and Literature from UNISA. So as well as being a poet, she is an academic and she has lectured for UNISA. But interestingly, when I looked at the CV that she provided for us, I noticed that what she foregrounded was the poetry workshops that she gives. And I think it reflects on her very close concern for people, her desire to enhance their creativity as well as her own. And that came first on the CV, and I thought that was interesting. It came in front of her very successful poetry collections. You know, she has produced three collections of poetry, I Flying and the Doo-Wop, Girls of the Universe, and also Notes from the Dementia Ward. And those have been prize-winning collections. She has three novels to her credit, and I believe she's working on another one, so that's something to look forward to. There's last year, she published Housekeeping for the Down at Heart. And I think it was a very, very much enjoyed novel. And the another thing that Fionnuala does, and is seldom perhaps known, is to write educational materials. And I think in that, one sees her meticulousness as a poet, but also her creativity. So those who are working with her materials, and I have done so myself in some teaching with her, see that they are very, very life and intellectually enhancing. And I think that says quite a lot for her. I think she's chosen Ingrid's book, Other Signs, a collection, to talk to you about today, because I think they have certain things in common, and that is a kind of compassion. They are very much women who live in the world. They don't live entirely cut off as poets and writers. They have domestic responsibilities which they discharge pretty well, and you know, they have that dimension which is so much more of a human being than just a poet. So I'd like you to welcome her, and I'm sure you will.
To Find Your Way Home By, I think makes my standpoint clear. That I think we use poetry, that's good poetry, as a way to get our bearings. Even people who never read poetry seek poems to help them navigate the big occasions of life. People are always calling for poetry when it comes to a birthday, a funeral, a wedding, or heartbreak. Of course, my personal mission is to get them to call for poems in all the other occasions, too. Good poems are like beacons or guides. They are other signs in the sense of being unconventional, unusual sources of information, not the headlines, not the cliches of conventional wisdom, not the lies of politicians. Good poems help us to find our way home to a sense of who we are, either on a personal, a national, or a universal level. And I'm going to begin with a discussion of the poem that gives the collection its title, Other Signs. This phrase occurs, which I quoted there, occurs in the second line of a poem called Vocation. I led myself here, though the honey guide helped. There were other signs. There always are. I want to consider these lines and this poem not just because they give the collection its marvelously suggestive title, but because it will help me to answer the question that if poems guide us, If they help us to get our bearings, then surely there are special requirements for becoming a poet, just as there are special requirements for any kind, other kind of pilot duty in the world. And what are these requirements? Surely in these days of books like The Artist's Way, and the next person who quotes that book to me might get a slap, anyone with a carriage return can become a poet. The title, vocation, of this poem, the title, vocation, suggests that poetry is a calling. I remember being told to pray for a vocation. It's a yoke willingly entered into out of humility and in a state of grace. But we also know vocation as in vocation and training. It has the more prosaic meaning of trade, something we can learn by being an apprentice. So the first line itself, I mean, in addition to the title, the first line itself is ritually ambiguous. It sounds so simple. I let myself hear, though the honey guide helped. So confiding, a natural speech act, which is what makes lyric poetry so attractive. Until you realize the paradox, either you lead or you are led. To say, I led myself here, is both an expression of agency, I lead, and a Mary-like fiat, be it done unto me, lead me. So we're getting some idea already in this first line of the negative capability that makes a poet, the capacity Keats referred to as existing, the capacity to exist in a state of uncertainty without any irritable reaching for fact or reason. So I said that right in the opening line we can see the poetic gift. We see it in the, we hear it in the confiding tone. We recognize it in the strangeness of the concept of leading oneself. We see it also in the perfect image provided by the honey guide. And the honey guide is a bird that is quite unique amongst birds in that it leads humans to beehives, knowing that humans will break the hive apart to get the honey, leaving lots of delicious wax behind for the honey guide. So it's a single word, a beautiful word with multiple resonances. In this image, we might read poetry itself as the sought-after honey, sustenance, a rare treat that is fiercely guarded by bees and that requires a breaking open. To find poetry as a vocation requires some kind of strange collaboration with other forces. But looking at that image, who or what is the honey guide? That's the vehicle, that's the image in metaphorical terms. But what is the tenor? What is the thing that the honey guide is standing for? Does the honey guide represent perhaps instinct or hunger? And the second line, there were other signs, as there always are, complicates the matter further, but again, in the simplest language. People think that good poetry, the people I sometimes have the misfortune to meet, think that poetry is about sparkly, unusual words. They like diamonds in particular. When in fact, it is about sparkly, unusual thoughts. There were other signs, not just the honey guide with its instinct and hunger. Other things brought her to poetry. Everything else is subsumed under the wonderful vagueness of other signs. The poem is going to go on to elaborate and catalogue these other signs, these other sources of inspiration and guidance, so that the poem will become almost a paying tribute, a poem of thanks rather than a poem of self-congratulation about how I got to be here. And as a title, the word signs really comes into its own, because as we know, you know, from the Bible, we would give us a sign, we would have a sign. A sign is a word linked to wonder, miracle, portent. The word sign tells you that there is meaning there. You just have to look for it in unexpected places. So looking at those first two stanzas, we've looked at the first two lines already. And we have to consider, what were the other signs that brought the poet here? Father's compass. suggests an inheritance of rational thought, of logic, which is strangely as necessary to a poet as mother's messages in the air, mother's intuition. And then in the second stanza, we have more, the list continues, white arrows at the crossroads painted by friends, which suggests to me the markers left behind for hikers by previous hikers, saying this is the way, take this route when you reach the crossroads. So signs, for me that image is a sign of encouragement, perhaps by friends, perhaps by mentors or poets who have gone before. And then the beautiful phrase, childhood's morse, how that contributes to the making of a poet. That secret language we have as a child, the slight desperation of childhood that sends out a morse-like message. The dense and secretive training ground that is childhood, and that all the best poets revert to in their poems, the private symbolism of childhood. And then all seven senses, she trusts that we'll know what they are. Well, we know what the five are. We know proverbially that there's a sixth sense. There have been suggestions that we should include pain, balance and time as further human senses. Then we come to the warning flares fired by strangers. And immediately there's a tonal change because we've had the friends and we've had family so far in the poem and now strangers. And what are those warning flares? It's an ambiguous phrase because are they helpful warning flares saying don't do this when you become a poet, don't do these things? Or are they more danger-filled signs, flares sent up by enemies, hostility, criticism, and God knows writers get a lot of that. And the hints of danger, which are signaled in that line, are then escalated in the line that follows, my country's graves, its electric fence. This is one of those sublime Ingrid de Kock lines. You wonder how long it took her to stalk it. So everything about the predicament of being a South African poet is summed up in those two images of the death toll, my country's graves. We just notice how that concrete image, it's almost a granite image if you think of gravestones, so much better than a junior poet who would say, all the deaths in my country, or all the deaths in this country. And then electric fence, which just beautifully symbolizes all the divisions and patrolled borders that can make life a misery here. So looking back over just these two stanzas, you can see the subtlety, if you just look at the line ends, you can see the subtlety and the intricacy of the sound patterning. The alliteration of Honeyguide helped, mother's messages, seven senses, flares fired, the half rhyme of air, ah, the three quarter rhyme of friends, senses, best. There's an intervening stanza I haven't quoted which gives the contents of a backpack that the poet needs on the journey to becoming a poet. Includes all kinds of interesting stationery and reference books. You'll need to buy the book to read that stanza. And then we come to this remarkably musical stanza. The stars, of course, were indispensable. Also the moon, though sometimes a bitter pill. And a little wind kept beating its veined wings for the willow and me to bend to its will. The stars join the honey guide and father's compass as part of the pattern of orientation imagery that runs through the poems. And since stars are any poet's stock in trade, we could assume that that image refers to the poetry written by other poets or simply a sense of wonder. Also the moon. The moon is linked to fecundity, and as poets we battle sometimes with the fertility or the lack thereof in our writing. And so in this line, bitter pill suggests months with no poems, contraception. After all these signs and maps, markers and guides, I want to just say something in between. This wind, the little wind that I love, it echoes, the little wind takes us back to that honey guide. It is bird-like. Since the wind itself is a metaphor, to compare the wind to a bird is to create a metaphor within a metaphor. And we get in those lines the whispery, wind-like sound patterning, which adds to the idea of allowing another hard-to-name quality, barely a force, to speak through one, the wind to blow through one, the poet as a wind instrument. So after all these signs, maps, markers, and guides, the next stanza, which I have again not quoted, ends with the marvelously ironic, "I am not lost." You've needed a lot of maps, but "I am not lost, though things are winding down to a once-breathing house." She is not lost because she is here, where she has led herself, to the home of poetry. This place, the here of the poem's first line, is also a real house, and where she writes, and the poet's body, or life, which is on a short-term lease. The jaunty backpacker that we met in the third stanza is replaced with an exquisitely sad singer who feels that song is coming to an end because of mortality itself, but also because of the common writer's complaint that the ink is drying up. We have a contrast between the full music of song, the lute is the poetic voice there, and the dry rasp of pen's scrape, the bottom of the barrel. But you don't have to worry, because whenever poets get onto death, you have to know we are half in love with easeful death. There's always kind of sort of a sweet pleasure to it. The rest of the poem, which I haven't quoted here, considers the approach of the owl of death, for whom this poet and all poets are necessary prey. By the end of the poem, death itself is a place we, all of us, lead ourselves to. And the silence of death, the end of song, has the consolation of being a resting place after the long hike with backpack following all those signs. I'd like to turn to a lighter, perhaps easier poem from the same section of the book, the section entitled Vocation. These are kind of companion pieces. They sit next to each other in the collection. My Muse is a Man. It's a delightfully iconoclastic poem. It takes that dreamy, hoary old idea of the muse, which I think has become in the popular imagination an airy-fairy notion to explain something no one quite understands, which is how do artists do what they do? Must be a muse. It takes that idea and turns it on its head. Instead of a perfect female physical specimen, alluring, devoted, subordinate, we are confronted with the portrait of a grumpy, irascible, demanding, harumphing man. My Muse is a man, not a woman. He corrects my first draft and my second. Not an icon, lure, or projection. No Dorothy, Beatrice, or Julia. I'm not sure who Julia is. He's a critic, a judge, and grammarian. He demands accuracy as well as passion, abhors emotion on the loose, imagination as excuse, glowers over spacing and spelling. The best poetry is resistant to clichés, stereotypes. It doesn't just avoid them, it reveals the truth that those clichés or stereotypes have been hiding. And here we get to the nitty-gritty of writing. Behind the airy fairiness of the muse is the first draft and the second draft. To the poets in the audience, look and listen. The first draft and the second draft. It's a painstaking vocation. He demands accuracy as well as passion. There's something wonderfully close to impossibility about those conflicting ideas, demands. How do you give everything, all in a rush of gut conviction, passion, and at the same time manage to be accurate, to use words and sounds precisely? The poem works as a witty and affectionate portrait, a tribute to a beloved mentor, but it also works as a useful catalogue of what poetry should and should not do. While most muses are cryptic, wild, mild, or remote, or so I am told, my muse has strong views. He asserts the primacy of sound, the way language must sing in and for its cage of meaning. Is scornful of lowercase, the elongated line, the sentimental rhyme, generic trees and birds, harsh images of father. Watch out, Sharon Olds. For me, what's interesting here is that meaning is construed as a cage. For the first time, I'm seeing the word cage not used pejoratively, used in an exciting new way, used positively. The musical aspects of poetry are in service to meaning. So much for freedom, so much for the anything goes school of profligate carriage returns and rhymes that murder sex. And he recites the words of his real beloved. This is the delightful irony of the unfaithful muse, who prefers another poet, prefers Thomas Wyatt, at least he's dead. The quoted lines lead one to the intertext of Wyatt's poem, which warns us not against the wearing of slippers, Dan, who so lists upon the slipper top, but against standing on the slippery top step of celebrity and fame, as Wyatt occasionally did in the English court. That quote from Wyatt, whose poem is actually all about death, leads naturally to the most memorable lines of this poem, and I often quote them to myself and to my students. Believes the best poems speak of death, also love, but mostly death. I love the pointed end stops of these lines, the curtness of the monosyllable, the unromantic sentiments, the frankness, the majesty of the generalization, and the slight nuttiness of the logic. That's why my muse is a man. This is probably where my lecture should have begun. I've spoken so far about two poems from the third section of this collection, and as you would imagine, the poems in this section, which is called Vocation, are all meta-poetic in the sense of being about the practice of poetry. And perhaps after love and death, the next great theme of poetry is the meta-poem, the Ars Poetica poem. So to answer the earlier question, how does the poet come to be a poet? Can anyone be a poet? What has made this poet a poet is self-reflection, discipline, a sense of vocation, a strict muse, father's compass, mother's messages in the air, my country's grave, its electric fences, and an intense sensibility dating all the way back to childhood. I'd like to stand back briefly and say a little about this writing career that Ingrid de Kock's Vocation has forged. And looking over this literary CV that you have in front of you, we see evidence of the self-discipline in the long wait between volumes, the restraint of output. In each of these collections, there has been what I can only call a nation poem, an iconic poem that has stood in for and up for the country's conscience in our most troubled hours from 1988 to the present. In familiar ground, it was the wonderful poem, Small Passing. In transfer, it was the title poem. In terrestrial things, it was all the Truth and Reconciliation Commission poems, but perhaps especially the Archbishop Chairs the First Session, which I've quoted there. In the volume that we are considering today, it would probably be the poem, Today I Do Not Love My Country. While critics fret about whether the great South African novel has been written, the great South African poem has been written more than once and by the same poet, who has made no public claims for herself. It's an impossibly heavy task to write a nation poem, to speak both personally and on behalf of others. And I think de Kock's status rests on the fact that she does this with such lightness and deftness, employing a faultlessly lyrical technique, musical, measured, understated, patent, concentrated, economical. She writes national poems that feel personal and personal poems that feel universal. These national poems have tracked the national conscience in our dreadful alphabet from apartheid and AIDS to the TRC and xenophobia, or A to X, if you like. The question in South Africa and in South African literature and poetry particularly has always been, who has the right to mourn and about whom? And of course, de Kock's answer has always been that we all mourn, we are all human. If you look at the lines I've quoted from the poem, The Archbishop Chairs the First Session, you'll see a list of, a kind of preempting list of some of the kinds of nasty little critical jibes that the minor critics that we have here send out to our poets. I'll just read the whole stanza. It doesn't matter what you thought of the Archbishop before or after, of the settlement, the commission, or what the anthropologists flying in from less studied crimes and sorrows said about the discourse, or how many doctorates, books, and installations followed, or even if you think this poem simplifies, lionizes, romanticizes, mystifies. There was a long table, starched purple vestment, and after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop, chair of the commission, laid down his head and went. That's how it began. So these critics, the ones mentioned here, seem to believe that a poet who writes about the grief of another appropriates that grief. For these critics, I suppose, only the victim, only the grief-stricken or the aggrieved may write of grief. These critics do not understand the vocation of poetry. If they had their way, nothing would be written, or it would be badly written. I'm going to look at the two nation poems from the collection Other Sides. And this one, Haraga, I'm as you can see from the ellipsis, I'm only quoting right from the end of the poem. Both of the nation poems that stand out in this particular collection are related to the 2008 xenophobic attacks, where 62 people were killed. The term haraga, she explains it in her endnotes, refers to illegal migrants who have burnt off the prints on their fingertips so as not to be traced and sent back to the state they are fleeing. I'm just quoting the last part of the poem, which ends with this beautifully hospitable invitation. Zeno, foreigner, stranger, guest, though my country hunts you down, welcome to my hearth. My friends will plead for you in court, but there is little we can do for fingers' seared memory and your frontier heart. Until DNA traces you to scarred city, dead kin, this door is open. Stay out if you mistrust these words, or come, however briefly, in. It's a poem of compassion and conscience, understated, reticent. You'll see in the previous, you'll see at the beginning there, where she glosses the word Zeno, she starts with the harsh word foreigner and ends with the highly respectful guest. And there's an explicit contrast between the predatory country and the poet's welcome to the very center of her home in the word hearth. The restraint of the poem is evident not just in the tone, but in the acknowledgement that there is little we can do for the frontier heart. That tight phrase, frontier heart, encapsulates so much. Distances traveled, the heart that has had to be brave, a survivor, resourceful, resilient, the person who has breached geographical and legal barriers as well as pain thresholds. The poet knows just how little she is offering and how suspect her words could be. This is not an expansive, fulsome, insincere wish, a mere courtesy or conventional utterance of pity, but an offer of temporary refuge until the government refugee agencies have their way and send the foreigner back. But back to what? Scarred city, dead kin. What an appalling return. What a non-homecoming. Thinking of her wonderful economy, early in the poem, in lines I didn't quote, there's the line, "They badly want to know who you once were." They badly want to know. Both the colloquial, "they badly want to know," and also, "they morally badly want to know." Now, just looking at the last two lines of this poem, "stay out if you mistrust these words, or come, however briefly, in." I'm struck by the craft that has gone into structuring them. There's the irony of a warm host voicing those words, "stay out," and the brilliance of that single preposition, "in," which is delayed to the very end of the last sentence and rhyming so pointedly and poignantly with kin. I've spoken before about this poem, so I don't want to go on about it too much, just perhaps to have a look again at the last stanza of this poem, "Today I Do Not Love My Country." First of all, I think this must have been an almost impossible poem to write because of the control it required. It's a poem that allows itself very few statements. I think most of us, if we had been asked to write a poem on the subject, would have let rip with a series of angry statements and accusations. But the poet allows herself only, "Today I do not love my country. It is venal, it is cruel." Those are the opening lines of the poem. Only those understatements. Not, "Today I hate my country," which many of us might have turned to, but "do not love." In other words, "today only I have withdrawn what I usually feel for my country, which is love." The poet does not comfort herself by disowning her country. It is my country. Not, you know, the way you hear people colloquially speak about "this country is going to the dogs." Say it, "my country." So I'm looking at the final stanza, where the statement, "today I do not love my country," has become, "today I cannot love my country." There is no choice but to refrain from loving, or perhaps she has tried but failed. It staggers in the dark, lurches in a ditch. A curdled mob drives people into pens, brands them like cattle, only holds a stranger's hand to press it into fire, strings firecrackers through a child, burns stores and shacks, burns. The nation has gone wrong, it has soured and produced this blood-curdling mob. The country is personified as a staggering, lurching drunk. The mob just strips others of their freedom and dignity and only holds a stranger's hand to press it into fire. Stranger, not the pejorative foreigner. The word "stranger" suggests it would only take an overture to make this stranger, a known person, a friend. The gentleness of this line contrasts so startlingly with the cruelty of the next. Press it into fire. Press is so close to an image of intimacy. We press our beloved against us. But press also suggests the kinds of rocks and vices used for torture in medieval times. Execution by crushing. And then to press it into fire. The fire starts here on the third last line of the poem, and it's going to stay with us until she gets to the end, as she's locating the precise image that will designate deliberate torture, deliberate cruelty, which is strings firecrackers through a child. The dreadful nimbleness of stringing firecrackers through a child, inflicting that on a child. So she ends this catalogue of crimes, of acts committed, but she refrains from judging other than with this withdrawal of love. And the wonder of that last line is it lies in the way the word burns is being used. It's being used both transitively, burns, stores, and intransitively, burns. This is a poem I feel no one else could have written. It manages to be filled with shame, and yet it remains somehow patriotic. I'm going to give you a bit of a release. The two poems we just looked at came from the first part of the collection, which is entitled Chards. And I'd like to end my lecture by looking at some of the poems from the delightful middle section of the collection, much lighter, friendlier, chattier, perhaps. If you haven't read poetry before, you could start with that section. And my favourite poem, I hear that my favourite poem was nearly rejected. Ingrid told me, I'm surprised you like that poem. She said, we nearly left it out. So, yeah, to tell you why I love this poem, perhaps I'll just read it since it's very short. It's called Coming and Going. At the back door, those leaving, dishevelled clouds, black umbrellas, rushed farewells, half lost in the rain, though we do hear goodbye, goodbye, thank you, thank you. We do see how heads turn to go before bodies are ready to follow. At the front door, those arriving are for a moment silhouetted in the sun. It streams through her diaphanous dress, and we see the lines of her young body beneath the fabric. We see his face with smile lines beginning to form, and they say, hello, hello, we are here, here, and they and we think they are here to stay. I think that, well, what I love about this poem is the way it reconfigures life and death, the dying and the youthful, as visitors, saying their goodbyes and hellos in the hallway of life. In fact, there is no other room in this house of life, just the hallway. We pass so briefly through. While the dead and the dying depart out the back door with black umbrellas, rushed farewells, those arriving expectantly at the front in see-through dresses are seductive, but also a reminder of the way of all flesh. And that line, those lines, heads turn to go before bodies are ready to follow, is a wonderfully apt way of putting the problem of how we lose our memories and mental faculties before our bodies seem ready to go. I really like the way this metaphor of greeting captures the rush and tumble of death. There's not enough time to take it all in. It's all a blur, as in this slightly chaotic punctuation, just commas joining everything. In some ways, it's a reprise of an earlier poem that I can heartily recommend. If you have her collection, Seasonal Fires, there's a wonderful poem called Time to Go. And it features, well, essentially the poet saying goodbye to Anki Kroch and her husband. It's dedicated to them, saying goodbye to them after what must have been a wonderful dinner party. And then she turns around at some point in the poem and thinks this must be what death would be like. With God sort of saying, you know, hurry up now, okay, say your goodbyes. Just want to introduce you to another absolutely wonderful light poem, just in case there is somehow by mistake someone here who doesn't like poetry. Meeting at this wonderful E.E. Cummings-like poem, Meeting After Much Time Has Passed. How are you, he asked, and was I fine? I was. Meetings between old lovers, haters, have a way of going along like this. Yarny, yes, fine. Hypodermic needlepoint. That's what it was like with us before, but he looked well, and he said he was well, and I was fine, yes. Older, fatter, but kind of better. Very well, too. There are other beautiful poems in this section about being a sister, being a daughter, and then there's the majestic villanelle, Married Late. So, I can certainly recommend those as a light introduction to excellent poetry. I've spoken about different homes in these in this lecture. The home of poetry, how the poet finds her way there with her backpack and the honey guide. The home of South Africa that can never be hated but only not loved for the duration of today. And the final home, death. The poet has another very local home, Cork Bay, and I like to read about it in some of her poems, like this one, Signatures. It's an example of how a poem can be built out of a simple train of thought, a stream of consciousness. Just track your own thoughts. Your own thoughts fall occasionally into poem-like structures. We just don't trust them, and we just don't take notes. It starts in medias res, and so, unexpectedly. With this voice you can trust, because it speaks to you, as Terrell said, about the stuff that you know about, an irascible year, insomnia, low-density bones, road rage, a torpid job, this job, to this, counting blessings on a calm summer evening. She ends that the first stanza on what would be a poetically very dangerous point, a cliche, counting blessings. May a good poet count her blessings. We shall see what she makes of it. I think what she does is she takes this cliche of counting blessings and she takes away its received quality. She makes it something new and inspired. So after the wretchedness of the year, a holiday mood settles on the poet. She takes in the comfort of abundance and plenty of the view from her house in Cork Bay. The plenty of the fish, you know, despite global warming, we are awash in ubiquitous snook and kabeljau. And the lastingness of the mountains, the durable Hottentots Holland. There are words in the poem that suggest the dangerous brink of things, like ledge, tilt, vulnerable, but those words are set against the solidity of ubiquitous and durable. There's always, of course, the possibility that we'll get things wrong, that a poet will misapprehend, as she does. She listens to wheels moving over those cobbled streets of Cork Bay, and she thinks for a moment she's hearing a horse and cart. I love that, a vulnerable sound, barely in memory. Sounds become vulnerable, just like fish do, I suppose. So there's always this possibility that we will, as poets, romanticize, that we will hear a horse and cart when in fact we are hearing, I don't know, an innocent centra. The blessings that the poet counts include the absolutely benign nursery ordinariness of Baker Man. Good morning, Mr. Baker Man. How do you do? The humble and the everyday are honored in a very witty way here. I think it's almost mock heroic to have the baker man sprinkled with confetti, as if he were being celebrated somehow or fated. And the simplicity of contentment is underlined by consciously childlike diction. Everyone at Café Olympia is happy and full, unless they get the wrong waitress. those evenings in Cork Bay, especially as you look out across to Hottentots Holland, have this kind of lavender-coloured glaze over the salted air. And just in case she's getting too romantic, she just so nicely brings it down with a peeing dog. Just to kind of counteract any hint of grandioseness. One, two, three blessings, all the way to overcountable, as children used to say, still say, despite advanced maths and astronomy's census of gyrating stars, stars now incandescing their signatures on the Duomo ceiling over my balcony choir. Now, I know a lot of poets who would have written their whole poem around those last three lines, not knowing that those last three lines have to be earned. They have to be earned through the simplicity and the childlike diction of the first part of the poem. You can only take flight, once you've established this base, and you have to have the peeing dog. It's the hard work that the ordinary words have done. The quotidian language of the baker man, the peeing dog, the pecking duck, builds steadily into this universal sense of wonder. The poet's home, where she stands on the balcony, has become the choir loft to the cathedral of the night sky. The starlights seem to scribble a message, their own names, across the sky. These are the other signs. Thank you very much.